appointed Chief Prosecutor of War Crimes before the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda and the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. In that capacity, she indicated she indicted President Slobodan Milosevic for war crimes. This is the first time that a Serbian head of state was called to account before an international court. Her legacy will forever include the recognition of the personal criminal accountability of heads of states that commit crimes of genocide or otherwise violate the basic human rights of persons and peoples. In 1999, Madame Aurore was appointed to the Supreme Court of Canada, where she proposed a progressive interpretation of human rights, often dissenting from her colleagues' more conservative approach. Her judgment in the Gosselin case would have expanded the economic rights of the poor by recognizing the welfare benefits must be at least as sufficient to ensure that persons do not have to beg for shelter or prostitute herself to get some food. In 2004, Madame Aurore was appointed United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. While in that position, she never hesitated to denounce injustice and oppression, even when it was committed by the world's most powerful states. She was much criticized by the Bush administration for her frequent complaints about the U.S., the use of torture, secret arrests, and its disregard for international law. In these challenging times, we should all practice more often the right to name and shame that Madame Aurore has carved out with such dignity, courage, and elegance. In 2006, Madame Aurore was keynote speaker at an international conference on LGBT human rights in Montreal. Thanks to her forceful appeal for protection of the human rights of LGBT people, the international community at the UN are finally starting to move on this issue. Despite the grumblings of the Harper government, Madame Louise Arbour was made a companion of the Order of Canada in 2007. She is honored and admired by human rights defenders here and around the world. Madame Arbour once stated, "It seems to me that anything that was related to full gender equality is a fundamental human right." In these hard times, when the federal government seems intent on attacking women's rights and workers' rights, when it is systematically neglecting the public interest and disregarding basic principles of democracy, I'm sure that the words of wisdom that the combative spirit of the truly honorable and just Madame Louise Arbour will be uplifting to us all. It is my very great pleasure to introduce to you Madame Louise Arbour. Thank you.
Indeed, and let me confirm, and I assure you already know, this is not my natural height. As I look to you, you do look a little bit like the General Assembly of the United Nations or the United Nations Human Rights Council, but somehow I think maybe a little friendlier. I'm extremely grateful for this opportunity to speak to you at this convention. And I hope that after my remarks that I'll have an opportunity to take questions and comments from you. And in particular, I hope that my brief time with you will give me an opportunity to learn more about the initiatives that you have taken as an organization to engage yourself on international human rights issues, not just on the promotion of human rights domestically, and in particular about your social justice fund. I've heard recently about this initiative. I want to congratulate you and to encourage you to continue very much your engagement in that direction. I will be speaking to you both in French and English. I will start my remarks in French, and then I will switch at some point. Mesdames et messieurs, à bien des égards sur le plan international, le 21e siècle a commencé le 11 septembre 2001 et sa première décennie politique se sera terminée le 20 janvier 2009. Une courte décennie, me direz-vous, mais elle est bien ancrée, bien encadrée par des événements et par des hommes, quelques femmes aussi, qui ont permis que se soit caractérisée cette ouverture sur le nouveau siècle par une quasi-obsession envers le concept étroit de la sécurité humaine et de la sécurité de l'État, et par l'adoption d'une méthodologie désastreuse pour y faire face. J'ai eu l'occasion d'observer plusieurs manifestations de cette obsession, particulièrement au cours de mes fonctions de haut-commissaire des Nations Unies aux droits de l'homme. Et je voudrais aujourd'hui partager avec vous quelques-unes de mes observations, et j'espère que ces observations auront une certaine résonance pour vous dans votre contexte professionnel et personnel. Je veux donc vous inviter à constater avec moi à quel point nous sommes encore à la recherche d'une vision commune et universelle de la sécurité et du bien-être auquel ont droit tous les êtres humains. La crise économique à laquelle nous sommes présentement confrontés se manifeste comme une menace interne et non plus comme un phénomène provenant de forces extérieures. Cette constatation, je pense, risque d'avoir des conséquences importantes pour notre perception de nos besoins sécuritaires et pour les stratégies que nous devrons mettre en place pour y répondre. Par exemple, alors que la ville de Vancouver a dû faire face récemment à une vague de violence presque sans précédent, et en particulier à des homicides par arme à feu menaçant la sécurité publique de façon alarmante, la ville de Montréal, par contre, a connu le taux d'homicides parmi les plus bas de son histoire en 2008, faisant d'elle l'une des villes les plus sécuritaires, les moins dangereuses en Amérique, sinon au monde. De façon plus globale, le nombre de conflits armés, tant les conflits internationaux que les guerres civiles, est en baisse croissante, et le nombre de fatalités associées à la guerre ne cesse de décroître. Ceci est par contre occulté par l'emphase médiatique sur quelques conflits, les moins représentatifs mais les plus politisés, comme celui en début d'année dans la bande de Gaza, ou comme tous ceux qui impliquent des intérêts occidentaux. En ayant choisi de vous signaler ces données pour faire état d'un dossier sécuritaire, j'ai évidemment déjà manifesté un parti pris, ou tout au moins un point de vue quant à ma compréhension de la sécurité, un point de vue qui révèle mon appartenance au monde occidental, et en particulier à un corps professionnel, la justice, la magistrature, le droit, qui a épousé un concept de la sécurité qui n'a aucune vocation universelle. Il s'agit évidemment d'une perception de la sécurité qui se préoccupe principalement de la criminalité et du terrorisme, et à un degré moindre, de la guerre. Par contre, pour les millions d'hommes, de femmes et d'enfants qui vivent dans la pauvreté extrême, pour ceux qui sont terrorisés par l'angoisse de la maladie, invariablement fatale pour eux, par la certitude de ne pas pouvoir manger à leur faim, ou par la préoccupation constante d'un manque chronique d'accès à l'eau potable, pour eux, le terrorisme international, la criminalité des narcotrafiquants organisés et les conflits armés ne sont pas inévitablement les sources premières de leurs insécurités. Plus près de nous et de façon plus universelle, les femmes, à mon avis, ont souvent une conception beaucoup plus globale de leurs besoins sécuritaires. Bien avant la crise financière et économique de la deuxième partie de 2008, les femmes nord-américaines vivaient dans leur quotidien une préoccupation plus intense que les hommes quant à leur bien-être économique et social, vu leur état plus précaire que celui des hommes sur le marché du travail et souvent leur responsabilité familiale accrue, par exemple comme chef de famille monoparentale. malgré leur vulnérabilité également plus intense que celle des hommes, à toutes les formes de violence, violence domestique et violence sexuelle en particulier, les femmes, à mon avis, ont mieux compris dans leur vécu le lien inéluctable entre le manque de sécurité et le manque de pouvoir. Contrairement donc aux bruyants discours véhiculés par ceux qui préconisent la sécurité par la répression, il est évident que l'insécurité n'est pas liée uniquement ni même principalement au crime et au terrorisme, mais que les insécurités les plus profondes sont ancrées dans la pauvreté, la maladie, la discrimination et la marginalisation. Le manque de pouvoir, de contrôle sur son propre destin, est un manque à la fois de liberté et de sécurité. Ces deux concepts, sécurité et liberté, que l'on dit souvent opposés, se rejoignent donc pour inviter une réflexion élargie du droit et du bien-être individuel et collectif. Ladies and gentlemen, this could not have been better expressed than by President Roosevelt, who cast the four freedoms upon which the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was launched as freedom from fear and freedom from want, freedom of expression and freedom of religion. And I pause here to point out that it is somewhat ironic that 60 years after the adoption of the Universal Declaration, the world is still ambivalent about embracing as equal freedom from fear and freedom from want. And the world often pits against each other freedom of expression and freedom of religion as proxies for the so-called clash of civilizations. But even within the more traditional security discourse, which is principally concerned with the repression of crime, including terrorism, there has been in the last decade a disturbing pushback against the legal constraints imposed on the state by the fundamental requirements of due process and the principles of divisions of power in a democracy. We have heard claims that fundamental rights and liberties, guaranteed, for example, by the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms or by a lot of international human rights treaties, that these documents impair the government's law enforcement efforts and therefore reduce our collective security. In its most extreme expression, this argument went as far as suggesting that the prohibition against the use of torture, an absolute and universally accepted prohibition, at least in theory, could jeopardize security operations, in particular counterterrorism operations. This, in my view, completely misrepresents the nature of our security interests. Security is, of course, a fundamental human right in the sense that people are entitled to turn to the state for their protection. That right encompasses the right to be protected against potential abuses of power from state authorities who are vested with a quasi-monopoly over the legitimate use of force. In fact, I suggest that we have an equal appetite for liberty and for security. In democratic societies, we ask our elected governments that they design and that they adjust at all times laws and practices that will ensure the proper balance between our desire to be safe and our desire to be free. As people and as communities, we essentially ask ourselves, how much of my freedom am I prepared to sacrifice to enhance my security? It is in answer to that question that we accept, or not, invasions of our privacy through electronic surveillance and lengthy detention without charges. In a perversion of that question, often fueled by unarticulated political interest, people who don't think themselves as vulnerable to abuse of power often hear the wrong question. They hear, how much of the freedom of others am I prepared to sacrifice to enhance my own security? The answer then is, of course, a lot easier, but the result is totally perverse. There's only one way to reconcile the tensions between freedom and protection, and that is through democratically debated laws enforced by courts, not by executive fiat. Ultimately, both our freedom and our security are best ensured by the enhancement of the freedom and the security of everyone else. But we must now turn to the broader security agenda, the byproduct of an economic crisis that for the first time in the generations of those who were too young to remember the Great Depression, forces us to question our faith in our eternal entitlement to a decent standard of living. And as we do so, we will be forced to consider our historic aversion for economic, social, and cultural rights, the second pillar of the international human rights system, and one that the Western world has been very slow to embrace. Substantially, the human rights framework is based on an integrated vision of Roosevelt's freedom from fear and freedom from want. The Universal Declaration integrated these two principles, which are collectively the foundation of both liberty and security, into a universal, indivisible web. The Cold War, however, led the West to embracing civil and political rights as the pillars of democracy and capitalism, while the Eastern Bloc purported to champion economic, social, and cultural rights as a reflection of the aspirations of an egalitarian society. Post-World War II, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights gave rise to the two great international covenants, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and of course the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, which in turn came to represent the fundamental East-West fracture that has survived to this day despite its diminished political significance. In fact, it is best illustrated by the fact that the United States has ratified the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, but not the other one, while China has done exactly the opposite, ratifying the Covenant on Social and Economic Rights, but not on Civil and Political Rights. The dichotomy, however, has now been reappropriated as a schism between the West and the developing world, or again, in geographic terms, between North and South. Developing countries argue that their need for survival is best expressed in economic, social, and cultural rights, such as the right to food, to shelter, to health, to education, and that these pursuits must take priority over the constraints imposed on government by civil and political rights. In contrast, Western governments continue to be wary of this perspective, as they prefer to view economic and social rights as political aspirations rather than enforceable rights, fearing that as enforceable rights, they would hamper free market practices or impose overly cumbersome financial obligations on states or both. This has been very true in Canada, where the judiciary has been slow to embrace any avenue for economic and social rights to be advanced as such in the courts. This situation fosters a climate of suspicion and easy assumptions of lack of good faith on both sides of the debate. Western diplomats who are engaged in human rights work question the bona fides of developing countries under authoritarian regimes with abysmal records on political and civil rights, but which purport to champion economic and social rights. And in contrast, the non-aligned movement, the Group of 77, and virtually all other spokesmen for a broadly defined South are very quick to express their suspicions about a hidden agenda in the Western promotion of human rights. In the most strident cases, they denounce Western human rights advocacy as neocolonialism, cultural imperialism, self-serving imposition of rules designed to protect Western economic interests. In a more subtle way, they also question the bona fides of the Western position, which is so reluctant to embrace social and economic rights and so tolerant of the grossest economic and social disparities, both within their own countries and between themselves and the rest of the world. Their suspicions are exacerbated by what they view as the repudiation in many Western countries of even the fundamental civil and political rights that the West purports to champion when it comes to the treatment of undocumented immigrants and of suspected terrorists with the subtext of racism and prejudice. In short, the fracture of the concept of indivisibility of rights shortly after the enactment of the Universal Declaration has taken political dimensions that render the advancement of all rights more difficult. In my view, the breakthrough must come from the West, as there is no rational basis for the reluctance to articulate a legal framework of protection for economic and social rights. To say the least, our tolerance for the unconscionable inequities and inegalities between and within states is not conducive to the fulfillment of the lofty promises of a just and peaceful world with people living next to each other in a spirit of brotherhood, as is contemplated by the preamble of the Charter of the United Nations. According to data published by the World Bank in 2004, the average level of real income in the richest countries is 50 times that of the poorest. And if the unfolding economic crisis penalizes rich countries that have abused the largesse of a poorly regulated free market economy, it is very unlikely to do so for the benefit of the countries left behind, many of which contributed to the wealth of others by tolerating an undue exploitation of their resources for the benefit, at the very best, of their personal leaders and very rarely of their general populations. In fact, the financial tsunami, which is threatening the perception of perpetual entitlement to great wealth in rich countries, is not only unlikely to redress worldwide inequities, but rather is more likely to further aggravate the plight of the world poor, if only by eclipsing the crisis in food shortages and prices, which dominated the world's international agenda less than a year ago. But it should come as no surprise that the political acuity of the food crisis would be short-lived, as its effects were quickly overshadowed in developed countries by a crisis in access to job and to credit, even as demands for food banks continue to increase. And it's not only inequalities and inequities between nations that betray the ideals of the United Nations Charter and of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Except for its weather, Canada is not a country of extremes. Historically, Canada has portrayed itself as an active promoter and defender of human rights at home and abroad, and has favored multilateral approaches to global problems. Indeed, I believe that this has become woven in the fabric of our national identity. Particularly since the enactment of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms in 1982, the values of freedom, equality, and tolerance reflect, I think, a very large consensus in Canada, despite the fact that these values have at times been tested in court cases where the result did not always generate widespread support. I think it speaks loudly of the deep roots of these values that they survive the turmoil of unpopular claims that are at times successful, as they must be. It also speaks of the trust vested by the Canadian public in courts, even when the outcome of a particular case is not widely popular. Therefore, I think we have no need to doubt our commitments to the values that underpin the Charter, as well as the Universal Declaration. But rather, we must question whether we have domestically and internationally adopted public policies designed to reflect and advance these values and supported our efforts by institutions capable of delivering on our aspirations. If Canada is to strive to implement its constitutional imperatives contained in the Charter and to live up to its international human rights commitments, it must establish for itself a position on the international scene that is consistent with these values and conducive to the improvement of all rights for all people at home and abroad. This is not a small task, particularly when the international human rights environment has become the preferred forum for testing out whether this so-called clash of civilization can be played out to shift the balance if not of real power, but at least of influence and allegiances. The role of Western democracies, and certainly of Canada, is ill-defined and at times is played erratically in this emerging conflictual environment. In my view, Canada's international human rights advocacy would be greatly enhanced by a stronger commitment to the legal foundations of social justice, including by an acceptance of the basic justiciability of social and economic rights expressed in the International Covenant to which Canada is a party, by an early ratification of the optional protocol to that covenant, which provides a basis for individual complaints. Canada's international posture would, of course, also be greatly improved by demonstrable initiatives for the implementation of the rights of Aboriginal people under the guiding principles of participation, transparency, and accountability, and by a reversal of the current government's opposition to the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Canada's human rights advocacy would also be rendered more credible and more effective should Canada attempt first to lead by example in other critical areas. In fact, such a remarkable example has been the setting up of two commissions of inquiry to examine the role and responsibility of Canadian officials in the abusive treatment of Canadian citizens abroad. The very public and widely followed O'Connor inquiry into the treatment of Maher Arar and the following Iacobucci inquiry have shown a commendable willingness on the part of Canadian authorities to account for what they or their predecessors have done in the pursuit of a counterterrorism agenda in partnership with others. It is regrettable that little cooperation was extended to these commissions of inquiry by foreign governments, and we would all be well served if similar public accountability initiatives were undertaken elsewhere. But obviously, subsequent apologies, even when accompanied by compensation, are a very poor substitute for avoiding harm in the first place. In this context, the continued refusal of the government to extend the protection of Canadian law to Omar Khadr by requesting his transfer to Canada from Guantanamo is harmful not only to Mr. Khadr, but to Canada's reputation and standing in the defense of fundamental rights and freedoms worldwide. I mentioned at the outset of my talk that we are at the crossroad of our insecurities. As courts are being seized in this country and elsewhere of some of the most disturbing initiatives associated with the so-called war on terror, we may see a readjustment of the excesses that reflected a disproportionate preoccupation with crime, including terror. I stress here my firm conviction that the criminal law system that we have developed over decades in manners respectful of the imperatives of the Charter, as well as reflective of new technologies and opportunities for enhanced effectiveness in law enforcement, have served us well and should not be presumed too weak to deal with novel and emerging criminal activities, including terrorism. It may need to be adapted to the particular international aspects of these criminal activities, but this should not be done by a total repudiation of the fundamental balance between liberty and security interests. Now, at the same time, the emerging and severe menace to our very social fabric from the economic crisis has been said to contain extraordinary opportunities. And I do not speak here of cynical references to bargains in the housing market, but of the opportunity to reconsider the wisdom of approaching our security needs and our fundamental rights in an integrated fashion reflected in President Roosevelt's fundamental freedoms, freedom from fear and from want, for ourselves and for everybody else. This is an opportunity that can help address the inequities in our own backyard, but also give us a blueprint for an effective foreign policy. No Western country, including Canada, has ratified the United Nations Convention on the Protection of the Rights of Migrant Workers and Members of Their Families. This convention, adopted by the General Assembly in 1990, came into force in 2003. It only has 41 ratifications, none from the countries of destination in the Western world. The convention offers protection to the fundamental human rights of both documented and undocumented migrant workers, who are defined as any person working for remuneration in a state in which he or she is not a national. The protection extends from the point of departure, the transit, and destination. It does not apply to refugees, who are, of course, covered by the long-standing refugee conventions. Rather, it addresses the plight of economic migrants, whose numbers are likely to continue to increase, whose methods of migration are likely to continue to be precarious, if not lethal in many cases, and whose reception in countries of destination may face increased hostility as narrow perceptions of self-interest will militate towards their rejection. Yet a more enlightened view, not only of human rights, but of global economic and security interests, is perfectly compatible with the aims and the means of that convention. And if there was any doubt about the need for basic human rights protection for migrant workers, the fears expressed by some in the last few days about the imminent arrival of seasonal workers from Mexico into Canada, in the midst of uncertainties about the nature and extent of the swine flu potential epidemic, should remind us of the importance of enacting policy responses that are compatible with fundamental human rights. At the G20 summit in London last month, world leaders committed to increase international aid to developing countries. And yet, the reality is that the value of official international assistance is about half the value of private remittances, money that migrant workers all over the world send back to their families left behind. In 2006, 150 million migrants sent home 300 billion to their families in developing countries. Many developing countries are heavily dependent on this source of income, with several countries receiving more than 30% of their GDP from private remittances. This flow of earned income, on which an estimated 10% of the world's population depends, is one of the most efficient forms of relief from the ravages of poverty. It reaches directly those most in need. It has a very low overhead, except perhaps from some of the regulations enacted to fight the financing of international terrorism, which has made the transfer of funds at times more onerous. So as we shift our Western focus from the so-called war on terror to our dire economic predicaments, we must ensure that we understand the full implication of the impact of that crisis and the impact that it will have on migrant workers, documented and undocumented, and on the billions of people who depend on their assistance for their very survival. At times of extreme vulnerability of the most marginalized groups in weak economies, it is safe to predict that migrant workers will be the most at risk. With this crisis, and the one that looms as a consequence of inertia vis-à-vis climate change, we are likely to see more, not fewer, people on the move as the world poor flee not only political persecution to become refugees, but also famine, disease, destitution, and despair to search for work and for survival. The economic crisis will dominate the West's political attention for months, if not years. It will inevitably lead to some international as well as domestic adjustments in financial regulations and in trade policies. If it leads to a more holistic approach to human rights, one that includes social, economic, and cultural rights, it may also contribute to the development of a more just, more equitable society, not just in rich countries, but everywhere. And this, in turn, may start to provide real security, the security that comes from access to education, to health, to housing, in addition to the security that comes from the eradication of crime and the suppression of violence. Mesdames et messieurs, au cours de mon mandat de haut-commissaire des Nations Unies aux droits de l'homme, ma tâche principale était de promouvoir et de protéger les droits fondamentaux des individus en interpellant les États comme détenteurs d'obligations en droit international. Il faut bien comprendre que les droits de l'homme se situent au cœur même de la relation étroite entre l'État et ses citoyens, en fait, entre l'État et toutes les personnes envers lesquelles l'État en question détient des obligations, y compris des non-citoyens sur son territoire, des réfugiés, des demandeurs d'asile, ainsi de suite. Il va sans dire qu'il est très difficile pour un acteur international d'intervenir dans cette relation, qui est une relation intime au sens politique, entre l'État et ses citoyens. Le bouclier de la souveraineté étatique s'élève dès la première tentative d'intervention. Cette difficulté est aggravée par le climat intensément politique dans lequel se déroulent fréquemment les violations des droits de l'homme, qui sont assez graves pour susciter l'intervention d'acteurs internationaux. Inévitablement ou presque, la situation est à ce moment médiatisée, ce qui rend un geste discret presque impossible. Les gouvernements interpellés doutent souvent de la bonne foi, sinon des intervenants professionnels, tout au moins de ceux qui préconisent, soutiennent ou exigent leur intervention. Bref, la promotion et surtout la protection immédiate des personnes dont les droits sont en péril s'opère généralement dans un climat intensément politique où plusieurs ont des intérêts qui ne convergent en rien avec les droits en cause. Cette situation est particulièrement aiguë dans les pays en voie de développement, où le projet de promotion des droits de la personne est souvent dénoncé par les gouvernements à leur convenance comme un projet occidental, voire même impérialiste ou néocolonial, en tout cas un projet financé par l'Occident et donc présumément à son profit. À ce titre, on accuse les pays occidentaux, en particulier les États-Unis, de politisation, de sélectivité dans leurs accusations, de se servir de deux poids, deux mesures, particulièrement quand il s'agit d'examiner leur propre performance. Au cours de mes très nombreuses missions sur le terrain, j'ai constaté à quel point l'écart entre le grand projet contenu dans la Déclaration universelle des droits de l'homme et sa mise en application est alimenté par une fracture entre les droits des uns et les droits des autres. La négligence des pays riches envers les inégalités inexplicables à l'intérieur de leur propre pays et plus encore des inégalités intolérables entre pays, sert de prétexte irrésistible aux pays moins développés et moins riches pour dénoncer la préférence occidentale pour les droits civils et politiques, pour la démocratie, pour la sécurité, et son manque d'intérêt envers la pauvreté, l'injustice sociale et les inéquités de toutes sortes, y compris celles basées sur la discrimination raciale, ce qui sert à les maintenir à leur avis dans une situation irréversible de sous-développement. Cette critique, notons-le, n'est pas toujours avancée de bonne foi. Elle sert en effet facilement de prétexte aux autocrates et aux kleptocrates de toutes sortes qui évitent de répondre directement à aux critiques qui leur sont adressées et qui préfèrent normalement accuser les autres plutôt que d'examiner leurs propres défaillances, surtout quand elles sont très nombreuses. Dans ce désordre qu'est la réalité de la gestion politique des affaires humaines, la contribution du juridique n'est pas négligeable. Mon propos est d'assurer que la popularité de la promotion de l'état de droit ne se solde pas par l'implantation d'une vision appauvrie et technique de ce concept fondamental au mépris de la réalité quotidienne de ceux pour qui les droits ne veulent pas dire grand-chose. C'est peut-être en effet par la promotion de l'état de droit en son plein sens que sera réalisée l'intégration des trois piliers de l'Organisation des Nations Unies. Le secrétaire général Kofi Annan avait puissamment décrété dans son rapport intitulé « Dans une liberté plus grande », un rapport qui préconisait des réformes très importantes de l'organisation. Il avait donc préconisé qu'il ne pouvait y avoir de sécurité sans développement, ni de développement sans sécurité, mais qu'il ne pouvait au fond n'y avoir ni sécurité ni développement sans la protection des droits de l'homme. Cet ambitieux projet d'instaurer un ordre public international reflétant la justice, l'équité, la dignité humaine, la liberté et la sécurité est à notre portée si nous favorisons dans notre propre pays une compréhension large et généreuse de nos besoins sécuritaires par une méthodologie inclusive reflétant le bien commun, et si nous rejetons les politiques de division et de confrontation qui mettent en péril le bien-être collectif. Ladies and gentlemen, I would expect these ideas to have particular resonance in an organization such as this one, which rests on a commitment to solidarity and collective action. On the international scene, even when it's not articulated as such, I believe that there's probably no more challenging political issue than to seriously enhance the protection of all human rights for all. But there's also no issue that could have a greater impact, not only on the lives of everyone, but as is the essence of human rights, first on the lives of those who need it the most. As we continue to deploy all efforts to prevent and to resolve conflicts, we must ensure that political expediency does not overtake the protection that international law extends directly to all human beings on the simple basis that we were all born equal in rights and in dignity. In my work in the International Criminal Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and for Rwanda, in my work as a member of the Supreme Court of Canada and as United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, I feel very privileged to have been party to this collective enterprise. As I'm about to embark in my new functions as President of the International Crisis Group, I will be addressing many of these issues from a broader political and practical perspective. I come to this new chapter in my professional life very encouraged by the magnitude of the social progress that I have seen unfold in this country in the course of my adult life. The most significant and the boldest progressive steps have been made possible by the coming into force of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms in 1982. This speaks very loudly about the power of ideas and of human rights ideals. It also confirms what the late Professor Herbert Packer said so eloquently about the law. And he said, the ultimate goal of law in a free society is to liberate rather than to restrain. I think that these words remain inspirational both at home and abroad, but they are certainly a call for our collective action. Thank you very much.